Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk about budget shortfalls facing community colleges and what it means for students and faculty. We'll also hear from local Jeopardy champion Amy Schneider about her new memoir for young readers. But first, the news coming out of Washington seems to be happening at warp speed. Between an onslaught of executive orders and a new budget resolution passed in dramatic fashion by the Republican-controlled House, it's hard to keep up with what is happening and what it all means for us here in the Bay Area. So tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by the San Francisco Chronicle's Washington correspondent, Shira Stein, here to explain it all. Welcome to State of the Bay, Shira.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how are you doing? It's a lot of news.
Tired. Good, but tired. It is always a lot of news in Washington, but when Trump is president, it is on warp speed. Yes, there's a lot of news.
I would imagine that your weekends are rarely free as a result. Yep. First, let's talk about the budget that was just passed by the Republican-led House. We're hearing that, we have until March 14th to get everything set up. What are the implications in that budget for the Bay Area?
Yeah, so there's two sort of financial situations that Congress needs to deal with. One of them is funding for the federal government, keeping the federal government open. That deadline is March 14th. Now, there's a separate thing the Republicans are trying to do to be able to pass some Republican priorities without needing 60 votes in the Senate. So that's things like they are trying to pass funding for the border. They are trying to pass more defense funding. They are trying to pass tax cuts, things like that. And so that is sort of the drama that's been happening in the one big, beautiful tax bill that listeners might have heard on the segment before. That's sort of the budget bill, whereas the appropriations is just normally we need to fund the government and the deadline is coming up.
Do you think that there will be a showdown, on March 14th about funding the government, given how Democrats feel about these budget cuts that Trump is proposing?
I absolutely do. I think in the end, they will likely fund the government. There's a colleague of mine who always says it's a no, 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 no until they reach a yes. Mm. I don't think they're going to shut the government down. I think they're likely going to do another, what's called a continuing resolution, which basically means, okay, we agree to fund the government at the exact same amount as we did before for a certain amount of time. So it means nobody gets new money, but nobody gets less money. So I think it's likely we'll see that, and then they'll probably negotiate a bigger full appropriations package.
And turning to the budget, how is it that the House is able to pass a budget without relying upon the Republicans in the Senate? Or if I have that correctly, how are they getting that done?
Yeah, so that is right now it's a sort of a Republican on Republican fight. Senate Republicans passed legislation to deal with that about 2 weeks ago, I believe. House Republicans passed it last week. But the big conflict right now is whether or not to include things like the tax cuts in this budget resolution. Budget resolution is sort of just a messaging bill. But once they pass that, that gives them the ability to then go pass something in the Senate without needing Democratic support. So that's why they're including things like tax cuts and immigration enforcement funding and the defense funding and things like that in that bill. They're sort of trying to get around the normal processes so that they can pass things that they know that Democrats wouldn't work with them on.
Right. We've heard a lot in the last few days about how Medicaid maybe is at risk, maybe not at risk. When it comes to cutting the budget, how Trump has said two things at the same time. One, that he supports the budget efforts by the Republicans, but at the same time that he would never cut Medicaid, a little bit different than Medicare. Where does that stand now?
Yeah, so in the budget that both the House and Senate passed, it calls for $880 billion in cuts to, they sort of categorize it in terms of the Committee of Jurisdiction. So in this case, it's the Energy and Commerce Committee. The problem is that Energy and Commerce, they handle, environmental programs, they handle Medicaid. The problem is that there is not really another option than cutting Medicaid. So the president has said, oh, we're not going to cut Medicaid, but Republicans have traditionally enjoyed putting more requirements on Medicaid recipients. So requirements that Medicaid recipients either work or look for a job. I should say that most Medicaid recipients are working or are in the process of looking for a job. There are very few Medicaid recipients that are not working or trying to work. So it just, things like that, block grant funding to states for Medicaid, so giving them a set dollar amount per the number of Medicaid beneficiaries. There are other ways that Republicans wouldn't explicitly be cutting Medicaid, but would result in fewer people having access to the program.
And how does that put any Republicans, I mean, in the Bay Area, I mean, we have the Central Valley, where there are so many Medicaid recipients, does that put some Republican, California Republicans in a bind?
Absolutely. This is the messaging that for the week or two leading up to this vote and for the next 2 years, we're going to see from Democrats. They're going to be hammering particularly David Valadao, Ken Calvert, and Young Kim, who are all California Republicans who are in sort of swingier districts. That's what they're going to be hammering them on for the next few years. Valadao actually wrote a letter to the speaker saying, please don't cut Medicaid because my majority Latino district would be harmed by it. Mm. So it's going to be something that likely comes back to bite some of these California Republicans in the butt. Not sure if that'll be enough to flip some of those seats for Democrats, but it does put those members at risk.
Let's talk a little bit about what in California, what concerns a lot of people, which is disaster relief funding and the money that the state gets from the federal government to deal with disaster relief. We had the big fires in Los Angeles and, you know, here, who knows what the summer will bring. Governor Newsom requested $40 billion in disaster relief for California. What are the key debates around that request and what conditions are Republicans or might Republicans attach to that kind of funding?
Yeah, President Trump has said that he wants certain conditions. He wants things like cutting back on California providing health care for undocumented immigrants. He wants certain requirements around water usage, many of which don't really have a real effect on preventing fires or treating fires when they do pop up. But because Republicans are in control of the House and the Senate and the White House, there's going to be some sort of negotiation. I could see what would happen is in the normal appropriations process, they negotiate, and that is sort of one of the things the Democrats get out of the appropriations process in exchange for their votes is some funding for California. I think what kind of conditions they put on it, I was talking to Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa. He's from way up Northern California. And he was telling me, you know, there's got to be some conditions. And I said, well, doesn't that concern you about if there's a fire in your district in the future and there's a Democrat in office? And he said, no, I think we need to do better about managing our money effectively is what he said. Yeah. So even California Republicans who are likely could face this same scenario in a few years, even they're thinking that this is the right option. So I'm gonna be keeping a close eye on sort of how California Republicans respond to the idea of conditions on wildfire aid. There are always conditions, but to put unrelated conditions is really what's at stake here.
It seems like just at this moment that Republicans across the country, regardless of if you're from California or from Wyoming, are pretty much walking in line and step with the needs and the wishes of the Republican Party. There don't seem to be any big breakaways, are there?
There have been. So the House of Representatives right now, Republicans have a extremely narrow majority. They have a 3-vote majority because they have 2 absences right now and because the election was so close for House districts. So if just 3 Republicans decide they don't want to vote for something, like with the budget bill last week, they kept a vote open, an unrelated vote open for over an hour while the president and the speaker tried to cajole those few remaining Republicans to vote in favor of the budget resolution. They ended up doing it, but it took a lot of effort. It is a lot harder for Republicans to keep their members together, especially in the House, where now a few sort of out there members can derail everything. Democrats traditionally are better at keeping their caucus together. than Republicans, and we're sort of seeing those repercussions in some of these high-profile important votes.
Trump is set to address Congress tomorrow. What do you think that he'll be talking about, and what in that address might be relevant to Californians?
I think we're going to see a lot about tax cuts. He will probably talk about the benefits of the tariffs that are taking effect in other countries. So he's got tariffs taking effect against Canada and against Mexico, and talking about the benefits for American businesses on that side. We haven't gotten a preview of his speech. Sometimes reporters will get it. But whatever they have written, it's likely that he's going to go off script and say something else. So I think we'll see some unexpected things. I mean, I was in the Oval Office last week with the president and French President Macron, and they were talking about Ukraine. And then all of a sudden, President Trump was talking about gold being stolen from Fort Knox. So I think that's sort of an example of, you know, things will go off script, things will go off topic. So trying to predict what this president is going to say is never ideal.
Right. I mean, I'm curious. You mentioned that you were in the White House for that presser with Macron and Trump. I mean, we've been hearing about new rules in the White House about who has access, who's in the White House press pool and who's not. How is that affecting your job in reporting? Have you been able to get the access that you need?
So it hasn't affected me yet. That was typically the way that it works, is there's sort of one person from print media who is able to be part of the pool, which covers the president and everything that they go to that's public. My last polling day was before kind of the upheaval where the White House has decided to take over who has access from a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has traditionally managed it. So it hasn't affected me yet. We will see when my next polling day comes up in a few weeks, whether or not they will allow. They've mostly stuck to the same schedule that the White House Correspondents Association has created, which has a broad range of publications. It has regional reporters like me. It has newer media outlets and online only, but it also has traditional print media like the Washington Post. So far, they've mostly kept to that. There have been a couple of exceptions, and they've also now added some interesting new media outlets. Particularly, I can think of one person who's been in there twice, one who asked Trump basically, why are you so popular? And then asked Vladimir Zelensky on Friday why he wasn't wearing a suit. So that's some of the additions that we've had to the pool, which have been interesting for sure.
Well, I mean, before I let you go, and I mean, it's been great to get your perspective on what's happening in Washington. There is a lot of news that's happening. This is your job to relay the news to readers and listeners. But for people who feel like a little bit overwhelmed by the amount of news and trying to keep up, I mean, what's your advice about how to metabolize and ingest all the events that are coming out of Washington these days?
Yeah, I think it used to be in olden days, you'd pick up the newspaper and you would read what's going on. I shouldn't say in olden days, but like a couple of decades ago, you'd pick up the newspaper and you'd read sort of a concise, dedicated version. We don't do that anymore. We listen and have incoming at us from every single area. I tell my family and friends, I'm like, please read my stuff. Please read your local newspaper. But otherwise, you can't possibly be listening to and reading everything that's going on. It's not healthy. It's not good for you. So pick your places. Like if you like listening to public radio, listen to public radio, get your news from them. They'll summarize it for you every hour. If you like getting your news from print media, maybe subscribe to a newspaper and read that newspaper every morning. You don't need to know everything up to the minute. And I know that's, and the antithesis of our business model right now, but I think it's more important that you give money to the one or two outlets that you think are worthwhile and help you, and try to kind of take a step back from the things that are just going to stress you out and make what is already a difficult environment to be in harder.
Well, that's good advice from a seasoned reporter, and you certainly helped us cover a lot of issues here tonight. Thanks for joining us, Shira Stein, the Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hope to have you back soon.
Thank you.
Yeah. And definitely, listeners, read her work. It'll keep you up to date. Next, coming up on State of the Bay, we'll talk to two professors from local community colleges who will break down how their schools get funded and how a looming budget shortfall will impact their colleagues and students. That's right after this break. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch, and I'm the host of KALW's new segment, Natural State. It features soundscapes from ecosystems all over California. It's a chance to slow down and listen up. Tune in every Wednesday at 7:15 a.m. and 3:45 p.m. Natural State. Only here on KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. The Bayview is having a moment with Louisiana's favorite meal.
You know, I always tell people the recipe itself is just really a roadmap. It's architectural plans. You still got to build it.
The power of gumbo. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Community colleges serve as lifelines for students from diverse backgrounds, providing affordable education, career pathways, and a second chance for those who need it most. But the funding formula created by the California legislature is benefiting some community colleges and disadvantaging others, including many of the community colleges here in the Bay Area. What is the formula used to budget for community college, and how does this formula compare to how California funds other school systems like K-12 and our university system? To help us unpack this, we're joined tonight by two people who have many years' experience with the California community college system. First, I'm pleased to welcome Sarah Thompson. Thompson is the vice president of the Faculty Association of California Community Colleges. She's also a sociology professor at Las Positas College in Livermore. Welcome to State of the Bay, Sarah.
Thank you, Grace.
We're also joined tonight by Matthew Goldstein. He's a humanities professor at the College of Alameda. Goldstein serves as the president of the Academic Senate for the Peralta District, where he oversees faculty recommendations to the chancellor and board of trustees for its four campuses, including the College of Alameda and Berkeley City College. Welcome to State of the Bay, Matthew.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Before we begin, I wanted to ask our listeners, we would love for you to be part of this next conversation. We're talking about community colleges and the shortfalls, budget shortfalls that they're facing. Are you a faculty member or student, past or present, at a community college? And what do you want to share about your experience in community college and what the budget cuts might mean for you? You can give us a call. We're at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or you can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Matthew, I wanted to start with you. You know, you're a longtime professor in the community college system, and you've seen firsthand the role those institutions play. Tell us a little bit about who your students are, how many students there are. Kind of give us an overview of who's at community college.
Sure, thanks. And one of the great challenges and pleasures of working in the community college system is that you get a great diversity of students. And it's even a diverse type of diversity. You get folks from all ethnic backgrounds, all socioeconomic levels, various ages, abilities, et cetera. So one of the thrills of working in a community college classroom is figuring out how to sort of pitch your material for a group of students who represent such a wide range of abilities and interests and backgrounds. The system itself serves 2 million plus, so it's a huge system, and you can imagine in a state like California what that means for diversity. So that's really the calling card of the community college system at large.
And Sarah, I mean, are community colleges and city colleges, are they one and the same?
Our community colleges and
city colleges. Like we have San Francisco City College. I mean, just for the listeners who might not be aware.
City College in San Francisco is one of the California community colleges.
And how many community colleges would we find in the state?
We'll find 113 in 72 different districts.
Wow. So that's a lot of colleges and a lot of people covered. And when you think about this community college system, Matthew, What kind of impact does it have? I mean, these are people who are seeking to get associate degrees or certificates. Is that right?
Correct. And vocational training. Mm-hmm. The other thing that often gets overlooked, though, is that a lot of folks just come to take a class and learn a little something about, say, auto tech or cooking or painting or what have you. And I feel like a lot of the coverage that community colleges get, which is too little, so that's among the reasons I'm very happy to be here tonight, Grace. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that gets overlooked is how vital a role in the community colleges play and how not everyone who comes through our doors is looking to get a certificate or degree. They're looking to improve themselves or to exercise or to hang out with other folks from the community. And I would argue that the colleges are quite effective in offering that, as well as, of course, the more traditional degrees and certificates and awards.
Well, my father is a proud graduate of Pasadena City College, and I am a proud attendee of first semester Spanish at about 7 different community colleges, I think.
Case in point, yeah.
So, and I'm going to give a shout out to my Saddleback Community College, where I grew up in Mission Viejo, California. So, Matthew, your district, the Peralta District, serves over 30,000 students, and you've given us kind of a picture of students that we might find generally at community colleges. Is there anything distinctive about the Peralta District that we might want to know about?
Well, of course. Yeah, it's
okay.
Incredibly unique. We're a 4-college district. We have, you mentioned Berkeley City and College of Alameda in your introduction. We also have Laney and Merritt Colleges in Oakland. Of course, recognizable and important names in the greater East Bay area. But yeah, the colleges really do reflect the great diversity and energies of the East Bay, and they are points of great pride to the folks who live in the areas. Merritt, of course, has a very rich culture and history. It's famous for being the home of the Black Panther Party originally. It now is in the hills of Oakland. At the time that Huey Newton and company were forming the party, it was down in the flatlands. And that's another story, but that's all to say that Merritt has a storied history and plays an important role in Oakland and the East Bay generally. And you feel that importance in local culture throughout the 4-college district, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with 2 million students in the system across the state, I mean, how many people do they employ, Matthew?
Oh, gosh. I don't have that stat in front of me, but I'll punt to Sarah. Maybe she has a sense.
No. Well, we definitely have, we are definitely the largest higher education system in the world. And despite that, still continue to have the lowest tuition in the United States for our students. In terms of employment,
well, it's a lot of people. We can say that. I mean, there's faculty, yes, and then the people that run the colleges themselves. I mean, and you mentioned the cost of taking a class at City College. I mean, it can be very, very affordable. Is there an average cost for a class or tuition for a semester?
The tuition is set by the state, mm-hmm, and it is per credit. So if you take a 1-unit class, that's one price. 2 units is, mm-hmm, double that. 3 units, triple that.
And what might those prices be, just for listeners who haven't paid a tuition bill for a community college?
Let's see. I think it's at one. Is it at 132, 142 now? 100 for a 3-unit class?
I think 46 a unit, as I understand it.
Yeah, wow.
So it's, I think it's in the, yeah.
Correct.
And
$46 to take a 1-unit class,
right,
at a community college seems like the deal of the century.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we would agree with you, Grace.
And, you know, you were saying, Matthew, that it's such a diverse group of kids. Like, unlike, you know, kids who are maybe starting out at UC Berkeley, they're likely kids who've graduated from high school and are finished, you know, high school and are going into college as a freshman. I mean, in a community college, Sarah, you're going to find people who are full-time employed or juggling family responsibilities. They can be a variety of ages. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, absolutely. One of the things that makes community colleges distinct from the CSUs or the UCs or other sister systems is that the overwhelming majority of our students are not taking what they would, what would be defined as the traditional full-time load, which would be identified as 15 units or five classes, right? Mm-hmm. Typically a semester. In fact, less than 10% of California community colleges are enrolled in 15 or more units. You compare that to the CSUs, where it's 25%, and then it's over 50% for the UCs. Mm-hmm. In fact, the overwhelming majority of California community colleges are not full-time at all. They're part-time. Mm. And so the reason they're part-time is because they are doing exactly what you just outlined. They are caregiving, or they are working, or they have life circumstances where they need to spend time either taking care of themselves or, taking care of their housing or taking care of their food insecurity. And so, therefore, taking a full-time traditional load, like the traditional upper middle class definition of college attendance, would require.
Mm. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about community colleges, and we're about to get into the budget shortfalls that these colleges are soon to be facing. We're joined by Sarah Thompson, a sociology professor at Las Positas College in Livermore. Thompson is also the vice president of the Faculty Association of the California Community Colleges. We also have Matthew Goldstein, professor of humanities at the College of Alameda. He's the president of the Academic Senate for the Peralta District, which includes the College of Alameda, Berkeley City College, Merritt, and Laney Colleges. We'd love to hear from you. Are you a student at a community college, and do you have concerns about what budget cuts might mean for you? Or perhaps you're a retiree or someone who's enrolled in community college for continuing education. You can join us by giving us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Sarah, the way these colleges are funded is not exactly straightforward. It seems pretty complicated. The legislature uses a formula called the Student-Centered Funding Formula, and we'll be calling it SCIF.
Yes.
So briefly walk us through how that works.
Briefly?
Is that possible?
I know. I have actually found that on average, it takes, and I have been educating legislators and different college districts and my own faculty on this model, and it typically takes about 3 hours to take someone from zero knowledge to understanding why the formula isn't working well for the state.
Mm.
As we are, have much more limited time than that.
Yeah.
I would say that when the SCIF was created, it came from a very good place initially, from good-hearted people who were noticing that our formula that we had previously, which was based purely on enrollments, just like the CSUs, just like the UCs, just like the K-12s, wasn't working for our rural and smaller college districts because their feeders were drying up, and there was no way for them to grow enrollments. And in an enrollment-based funding formula, that's basically the only way you can increase funding. So they thought of the idea, how do we get more resources to these more marginalized places in the state where the economies aren't as thriving, right, as they are in our more urban areas? And so they came up with this SCIF. And so the SCIF actually measures many, 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 many different things at the community college. In fact, if I were to list it, it would sound like the end of a pharmaceutical commercial where they list all the possible side effects. It requires a lot of data mining. It is a very expensive funding model to administrate. But they were hoping that, hey, if we measure lots of different things, maybe these more marginalized districts would have a chance at increasing their funding. What they didn't think of were the other potential kinds of consequences, which would be that these many measurements, not all districts would be able to reach the targets that they set for them. So, for example, one of the most important parts of this new funding model that goes beyond enrollments is looking at a poverty index, essentially, right? Like, how many students of need are you servicing? That's a very tricky question because it requires a very sophisticated type of measurement, because who is living in poverty in San Francisco is very different, right, than who is living in poverty in you know, in the rural areas outside of Bakersfield, right? The poverty index, even the poverty income levels that designate if someone is, you know, living in poverty and not, is much higher, right, in the urban areas because there are higher costs of living. So what that means is that the districts that are located in these high cost of living areas, basically their students who are in need become invisible because they earn too much to be recognized as being housing insecure and in need. And that it helps explain the Peralta system's vulnerability in this model. It also explains my district, Chabot Las Positas's. It explains City Colleges. It explains Foothill De Anza's. It explains Ohlone's. Almost every Bay Area district is harmed by this model because our students in need are invisible and
under that one metric that is being used, among other metrics, though, is what
right.
you're saying.
And that metric ends up affecting many other metrics in there.
Ah, so there's a domino, waterfall effect.
Yes, it's a domino effect.
Got it.
Right.
Got it. How long has this SCIF system been in place? Is it brand new, or has it been around for a while?
Well, one could argue it's still not fully in place because the majority of districts in the state still cannot be funded by it.
Oh.
So they have created these side-by-side different models that, okay, if you can't be funded by the SCIF, we'll create another category for you called Hold Harmless, and we'll create a third category called Stability. And so you literally have three funding models all operating at the same time with different districts trying to decide which model they want to be funded by in that particular year.
Well, I guess I should ask, just stepping back, how much money is the state putting into the community college system through these various funding models? Are we talking hundreds of millions, tens of millions?
Oh, billions.
Billions.
Yeah.
Billions.
I mean, we are, you know, we serve over 2 million students, so we are.
So it's trying to figure out a way to fairly divide this big pot of money among the various community colleges. And I think what you, Matthew, and Sarah are saying is that being in the Bay Area, the system, the SCIF system, unintentionally penalizes districts like yours. And are you seeing that, Matthew, in cuts in funding at the district level?
As a matter of fact, we are at Peralta, and I'll touch on that in a moment. I just wanted to credit Sarah with being early to the game and understanding right away that SCIF was going to pose problems for districts like ours. I first met Sarah at a meeting of local senates, and this was before the SCIF was enacted, and she was already sounding the alarm on the SCIF front for districts like ours.
Yeah.
That said, we just had a board meeting on Tuesday night where a number of administrators and classified professionals were laid off. So pink slips are being ordered now ahead of the March 15th deadline. So there are very real consequences of the changes to the funding model. We're held harmless, which means we're getting the same level of funding for the foreseeable future until such a time that we meet the metrics of the new SCIF formula.
Mm-hmm.
But informed observers are dubious about our ability to hit those metrics.
Yeah, what happens if you don't hit the metrics?
Well, Sarah?
Well, if we don't hit the metrics, the state has decided that we will not be eligible for cost of living, for any kind of COLA, like
increases.
And it should go without saying that our health care is increasing just as much as health care is across the state. And, you know, we have employees that are facing the same kinds of increases in prices and housing and food, et cetera, that everyone else across the state is. So not getting a COLA is essentially a cut. When we look at the students in our districts, they already are discriminated against because their poverty is not recognized. So they don't have access to things like Pell Grants, right, which are the federal financial aid that is afforded to students who have low income thresholds. The colleges they're attending, right, are already punished for not being able to meet these SCIF metrics. And so their colleges face, you know, financial shortfalls. And then now this is going to be this third this third penalty, which is, and now you will not have COLA, which will be an additional cut. And so the way in which students experience this is that when districts experience big cuts, one of the target populations for layoffs are our part-time employees. And the overwhelming majority of part-time employees at community colleges are faculty. Mm. And so when you cut faculty, you cut classes. So cutting classes, cutting counseling, cutting library hours, these are all the quick cuts. And so we have seen, right, in our districts, you know, hundreds of layoffs of part-time faculty. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're a district that's growing, mm-hmm. our district has grown by 20% over the past 3 years in terms of enrollments. We're still cutting classes because that is, because we have to.
Yeah. We have an email from Rick who writes, instead of cutting actual courses and services like disabled student programs and supports, why not cut a bunch of overhead? Matthew?
So I mentioned that there were layoffs at our place that were announced last Tuesday night. And in fact, the administration has cut nearly 30% of its own in that move. There is talk, as was reported in the Chronicle recently, about combining colleges in our district. That's something that I've heard talked about recently. That would be several years down the road, as far as I can tell. But in terms of overhead reductions, we do have a new central office staff that is determined to do things like bundle our energy costs across the four colleges and collaborate more energetically, let's say, to ensure that we do use our taxpayer money wisely. But it's a tricky question. It really is. How to make those savings and yet still provide the services that Sarah just outlined.
Well, I'm sure it must be frustrating for students. You know, they're trying to get as many credits as they can to maybe get their associate's degree or get the vocational training that they need. And if they can't find the classes, especially at the times they need, when they need, it just lengthens the process in attaining a degree and maybe even discourages a person from continuing. Have you seen that, where people just drop out because they're so frustrated because they can't find the classes they need, Sarah?
You definitely do see when there's a lack of access, and that's how we frame it, right? When you don't have classes, students don't have access. And when students don't have access, it does lengthen their college experience, and the longer the college experience goes, the less likely they are going to actually complete a goal, right, that they had begun. So it is really a critical aspect to give students, you know, as much access as possible. When students have to wait a month to get a counseling appointment, they're right. It's very discouraging. And students, especially our most vulnerable students, tend to feel very isolated and, for lack of a better phrase, sometimes experience imposter syndrome, right, when they come into our campuses. And if we can't meet their needs immediately, they are more likely to become discouraged and leave altogether.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have the SCIF. Basically, you've just described three different funding models.
Yep.
Hold harmless, the SCIF, and there was the third. Yep. I mean, what's the solution here? I mean, with a finite pot of money, Sarah, like, what's the best way to make sure that colleges across the state are funded in a way that makes them viable?
Well, as I said, the SCIF came from identifying a problem with the previous model, and sort of responded with a model almost on steroids that took out a whole other section of the state in terms of their financial solvency. We do need to create a model that helps subsidize our more vulnerable regions. When you are very isolated from urban areas, it is more challenging to get resources, including labor, including personnel. So these districts have to basically match the salaries of the urban areas just to recruit. And so they do need a subsidy. They do need a boost. But that boost shouldn't come at the expense of, you know, the majority of our students in the state, which are in urban areas.
Mm. I'm sure it varies from college to college, Matthew, but I mean, how much does tuition cover the cost of operating a community college? What percentage?
That's an interesting question. I don't actually know the percentage, but it's
10%.
It's 10% of the tuition is covered by...
No. 10%
of the
10% of our revenue is tuition. Covered.
And is there... I mean, we were talking about what a great value it is, you know, $46 on average for a single credit. Is there a move to raise tuition?
No.
Because...
I think it's the commitment to open access and the idea of we want to encourage public education and get folks involved in the educational process. Mm-hmm. So I've not heard any discussion at all about increasing tuition.
Not recently, yes.
Yeah, well, that's encouraging. I mean, I remember the golden days of California, and the idea was you would go to community college to get an AA and then use that to go apply to a Cal State or a UC to get a BA if you wanted to do that. Is that still even a viable path forward, Sarah, given what you've described? Or are the budget cuts making that increasingly more difficult?
Yes, it is definitely still a viable pathway. Yes, our transfers from community colleges to the CSUs and UCs have dropped over the past few years. And that, of course, is part of the reason the CSU, right, is struggling, because this transfer population that they depend on, they also have issues with freshman enrollments, too, but the transfers have definitely decreased. The UCs can balance that a little bit more by just having bigger freshman classes. So part of the challenge of the budget model is that... whereas it can open up access from in the more marginalized areas, right? Most of the growth is actually occurring in the more urban areas. And so by compressing how much we spend per student, for example, most urban areas only get $9,000 per full-time equivalent student, mm-hmm. right? But when we look at the more rural areas, they're averaging about $14,000-$15,000 per. So we have less money to give our students access, which can definitely interfere with their pathways in an efficient, timely manner.
Mm. We had a caller who asked, what happened to the proposal to allow community colleges to give bachelor degrees? Is that still on the table?
They are.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, great.
Yes.
In the minute, we have like 30 seconds left, and Matthew, I want to give you the last word. What do we, as listeners and people who care about community colleges, what should we be doing next?
I would say take classes. Go to your local community college and sign up for classes and show up and enjoy what they have to offer. I think that vision that you described before is still very much alive, Grace. There are challenges, certainly, but I strongly encourage listeners just to go take a class at your local community college.
I couldn't agree more. I've taken classes at City College and I've loved it. So I want to thank you both for being here. It was such an interesting conversation. We've been joined by Sarah Thompson, a sociology professor at Las Positas College in Livermore, and Matthew Goldstein, professor of humanities at the College of Alameda. Both of them are working hard to keep community colleges open. Thanks for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Hey, thanks so much for having us, Grace.
On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss the importance of environmental journalism. Trump has appointed people to key posts with ties to the oil and chemical industries, ordered the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, and pledged to roll back climate protections across government. He also just fired hundreds at the climate agency NOAA. How should journalists cover the administration's moves to stop climate action? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Ethan Elkind, and you.
And that will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that takes place this evening at 7 o'clock on 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. The category, Jeopardy champions. The clue, the most successful woman ever to compete on Jeopardy and the first openly transgender contestant to qualify for the Tournament of Champions. Answer? Of course, it's who is Amy Schneider? A resident of Oakland, Amy's a software engineer and the author of the memoir, In the Form of a Question, The Joys and Rewards of a Curious Life. A young reader's edition of the book, entitled Who is Amy Schneider? Questions on Growing Up, Being Curious, and Winning It Big on Jeopardy! Hits bookshelves tomorrow, and we are delighted to have Amy Schneider here on State of the Bay. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
You know, after your Jeopardy! Success, you wrote a memoir, which you've now adapted into a youth version. What inspired you to share your story in book form, and why do you think it's important to create a special version for young people?
Well, I'm always happy to talk about myself. So telling my story was always something that appealed to me. And after my initial run on Jeopardy!, I had a literary agent reach out. And as I was working on the book, I realized that there were things that were important to me to include that were not appropriate for younger readers. And I was disappointed by that. It was a trade-off I felt like I had to make, but that's an audience I wanted to reach. And fortunately, my agent primarily works with children's literature, so was very much on board with making this adaptation. One sort of the guiding thought was, what would I like to have had available to me when I was a kid that wasn't around?
I think kids might find lots of entryways into this biography. And one of them is that your eighth grade class voted you most likely to appear on Jeopardy! Those categories sometimes that we vote for kids, yours is one that came true to life. That must give you a laugh or two.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I tell people it was a class of 20 and we all got awarded most likely to something. But I had at that point been watching Jeopardy! For years because my parents watched it. And at the time, as an eighth grader, I was very cocky and I was like, oh, yeah, sure. I'm definitely going to be on Jeopardy! And be the best. And then by the time I was an actual adult and was on, I was like, oh, we'll see how it goes. You know, I wasn't quite as confident as I was back then.
Well, what I loved reading about was that on the day that you were on Jeopardy!, you started to feel nervous, which makes sense. But one of your anxieties was that this was a dream that you've had for so long. And at the end of the day, it was going to be over. And I think that's something people can really relate to, holding on to a dream and then maybe getting that chance to experience it, but worrying that it's not going to live up to what people had hoped for.
Yeah, that it won't live up, or even just being focused on the end while you're still experiencing it. I mean, it's like being on vacation and stressing out about the fact that you're going to have to go back to work, which is definitely something I've been known to do, is a very understandable sort of feeling. But it's worth remembering that the point of the dream or the experience is the experience, and not to ruin it by focusing on the fact that it's not permanent.
Mm. Well, since this is a book that's geared for a younger reader, as you sit here today, Amy, what are some things that you would want to have heard as your younger self?
Well, my pat answer to that is always, trans people exist. That would be
yeah.
Me. But I think beyond that, the possible outcomes for your life are so much broader than you think. There are going to be so many chapters in your life and you cannot predict how they are going to go. Like even before Jeopardy, there's so many aspects of my life that I could never have predicted. You know, I'm just living in California is something that I'd never particularly expected, but that's where my life took me, especially for kids who feel like they're being tracked in certain ways, and even up into to the point where you're picking a major in college and be like, oh my gosh, I'm figuring out my whole life right now. You really are. Your life is going to change in ways that you couldn't predict.
You moved from Dayton, Ohio to your dreamland, Oakland, California. Talk a little bit about that move and how you say you can't really explain why Oakland has been such a great change for you, though I suspect it's because of the friends that you made.
I mean, absolutely. It certainly is a place where the people I meet are people that I'm comfortable around, people who are intellectually stimulating, and then really just the variety of people that you might meet. One of the key moments in this decision was when me and my wife at the time came out to visit some friends at Berkeley. It happened to be Pride weekend. And, you know, we were theater kids. We were in those kind of communities in Dayton. But just seeing so many more types of queer people than we had ever seen before. Just the sheer variety, like you can find everyone in the Bay Area. And that's something that I really value.
I think that level of comfort that you had in your community may have helped you in your journey to find yourself. As you write in your book, a lot of people ask you, like, when did you know that you wanted to be transgender? And you point out that there's not one moment per se, that there's all these clues and moments because we're all growing, we're all in this journey of life. But how did the community around you help you in your journey? And what advice do you have for younger people who are trying to find and understand themselves?
Yeah, I think the experience of just actually meeting, quote unquote, real life trans people, you know, one who I've mentioned before is the comedian Natasha Muse, because I was a bit involved in the stand-up comedy scene at the time, and seeing her and seeing that she was just a woman that lived with her wife and they had a couple of kids and there wasn't anything weird about her at all. Because I wouldn't have consciously said at that point that trans people were weird, but there was still a part of me that thought that until I'd actually met and gotten to know a few trans people. In terms of trying to find yourself, I think find real people and they're going to teach you so much more than anything else can.
That's what's so nice about your book, because you speak very honestly about your journey in a way for younger people to absorb. We're not in a great time with the Trump administration and the targets to the transgender community. And as a very visible member of that community, I mean, what are you experiencing right now and what are you feeling?
You know, a bit of a roller coaster. I mean, I'm not going to say that it isn't painful to be attacked so viciously and to be singled out, not just because of who I am, but because of how few of us there are and how politically we're an easy target. I hate that. It's no good. That said, I am fortunate enough that I can speak up. And the thing that I always come back to is the place that they're trying to put trans people in society is where we started from. Like, there isn't anything they can do that is worse than what trans people have already overcome.
There's a lot of conversation about young people who still require parental consent to make changes to how they want to identify. And those kids are being particularly targeted by laws that are curtailing healthcare. What message do you have to families like that?
I guess it's just that the people that are on the attack are the loudest and the voices you hear the most, but there's a lot more support out there than maybe it feels like there is. And also, what I would tell them is what they already know. You love your kid and you're going to do your best to do what's best for them. And whether or not that's the most progressive option, whatever it is you feel is best and safest for you and your family, you've got my support.
You mentioned your love for theater, and I know there's a lot of theater kids out there. Tell us a little bit about theater, what it meant to you, and how it helped you find your voice.
Yeah, I was a very kind of closed off, shy kid, and I didn't feel safe trying out different things. And theater gave me a safe space to do that. I could try feeling different ways and expressing myself different ways. And I wouldn't get in trouble for it because it wasn't me. That's just what the character called for. I think the other thing about theater that's really amazing is you get used to failing in public. You're going to have bad nights. You're going to flub a line, miss an entrance. Like, these things are going to happen. And the show keeps going and you get through it. And I think that aspect in particular was a big help being on Jeopardy, because I was able to not freak out about the fact that I might get some answers wrong. I might make some mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Well, winning on Jeopardy was on the Amy Schneider bucket list. What else is on there? What can we expect next from you?
Well, to an extent, I'm figuring that out, but I am actually getting back into stand-up comedy. SF Sketchfest, I was fortunate enough to get on a bunch of shows there and do a stand-up set. I really enjoyed that. And some sort of podcast/YouTube thing that's about exploring the many things that I'm interested in. And then the other thing is, I really want to do a play again. I was a community theater actor, not like professional grade, but I miss it a lot and I want to do it again.
Well, I think if we say, who is Amy Schneider, we would have to say, Google and find out more. We're going to have to leave it there.
Amy Schneider's youth memoir, Who is Amy Schneider? Questions on growing up, being curious, and winning it big on Jeopardy! Will be in bookstores tomorrow. It's such a pleasure to talk to you and such an inspiration as well.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Today's show was produced by Katie Colley and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Make sure to join us next Monday when we'll be talking with Kevin Fagan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning San Francisco Chronicle columnist, about his new book on homelessness. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.